Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Comté Cheese Association. Comté, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at comté-usa.com. That's comté-usa.com.
This week, Team HRN is at Charleston Wine and Food for the fifth year in a row. So, on this week's Meet and Three, we bring you some of our favorite sound bites from last year.
The hospitality here and the camaraderie is really wonderful.
Yes.
That's what struck
Everybody
me.
Smiles. Yep.
So, imagine if you mix dirt with sand.
Yes.
You've got our earth.
Yes.
That sounds like that would be really poor.
Really poor, right? You know, we can talk all we want about a good story, but a good story is useless if the wine isn't great.
It's highly Instagrammable. It looks so gory.
Tune in to Meet and Three, HRN's food news and storytelling roundup, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome, everyone, to Cutting the Curd. Today, I have Jessica Little from Sweetgrass Dairy. I'm Kara Warren, and we're going to talk about cheese from Georgia. Jessica, how are you doing today?
I am great. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Awesome. So I love that you were on the show 10 years ago, to be pretty much exact. That's kind of amazing, in my opinion. How do you feel about that?
You know, it's so crazy to stop and think about it. On one hand, I feel like time has flown so much and just so fast. And then on the other hand, I'm like, man, we really are this crazy that we're still at it 10 years later. I think I had just had my fourth child, so I was very sleep deprived. And hopefully didn't sound too ridiculous on the last interview.
No, it was amazing. I mean, at this point in time, Anne Saxelby was the host. You know, you were, I believe, just selling cheese in Georgia or in the South. And from what I could tell, this surprised me. You had cow and goat's milk cheese.
We did. We made both for at least 10 years. And then, Sweetgrass Dairy was started by my parents, and Jeremy and I moved to the creamery about a year into the life of the creamery. So I grew up on the dairy farm and was very, well-versed in, I guess, animal agriculture, enough to know that I didn't really want to be a dairy farmer, but
I feel the same. Everyone asked me, oh, you sell cheese. Could you make cheese? I said, no, no. I couldn't be a dairy farmer, at least. You know what I mean? Like, it's a different type of lifestyle. So anyway, you were saying.
So much work.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's so much work. And so we moved to the creamery about a year into the life of the cheese. And by 2004, my parents, you know, definitely believe in giving opportunities but not handouts. So the business was not yet operating in the black. And they said, if you want to buy it, here's an opportunity. Because as you can imagine, we just had some student debt. We had no cash savings or anything. We were just, it was a good time to buy the business, you know, and so we did. And
that must have been so scary, though. I mean, to the idea of buying a business at any point in your life is like, oh my God, here it is.
Well, you know, yes and no. I think when you have very little to risk, you know, it wasn't so bad. And maybe it was, you know, I have very entrepreneurial parents. I always knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I just didn't know what, you know, avenue I was going to take. And so I was definitely much more comfortable with the idea of owning a business. And the funny part, you know, I think I chose a partner very well in that Jeremy is actually very, very risk averse. We're very, very different people. And if it were up to me, I probably would have run the business off the cliff many, many years ago. And if it were up to him, he would never have had the business in the first place. So just together, we make a good team and keep each other in check. And so it took a lot of, I think, convincing on his part, but I was ready to jump in the deep end. But I believed so much in what my parents were doing. I believed in how they were farming and how different that was. I was able to see, you know, both conventional and New Zealand rotational grazing. And I worked in restaurants all through college, and I knew that chefs were looking for great food and that there was, you know, this great opportunity and this great platform to be able to help, you know, cultivate this inspired American food culture and tell the story of our region, and Chiefs just happened to be it. So we kind of jumped at that opportunity. But, you know, thinking back on it, I think we were also very sleep deprived, children and goats and cheese making and all that. So we probably weren't the most rational in making those decisions.
Oh my goodness. This is four children at this point, you're saying?
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, by 2010.
Okay, so by 2010, yeah. Oh my goodness. Yeah. And you mentioned, I just want to confirm and reiterate to the listeners, your mom was in animal science and your dad was interested in rotational grazing. Is that what you said?
So, so my parents, my dad is from a long line of dairy farmers. He grew up in Western New York, but ended up going to college at the University of Georgia, where he met my mom. So they both have degrees in animal science, for a little bit of time, both of them thought they wanted to go on to vet school, but they did not. They did not.
Yeah.
And, so they farmed in a conventional manner, the way that, you know, universities were teaching back in the 70s and early 80s. And they were very successful at that, but it was not a great lifestyle for them or mm-hmm. for the earth or for the cows. And so in 1993, they switched over to that New Zealand rotational grazing style. And the milk was just so different. It was so delicious that by the time I went to college and my two brothers went off, my mom's wheels were kind of turning on how in the world could she tell the story of this sustainable agriculture and regenerative agriculture and humane animal husbandry, and cheese was the vehicle to do that.
I mean,
it was her brainchild.
I love that. I feel like women have the best ideas. No offense to the other gender, but I just feel like there's a superiority there a little bit.
She is such a visionary. There's no doubt about it.
Oh, yeah. See?
She is definitely the one driving the bus.
I would love to have coffee or tea with your mom. She sounds, I mean, if she, you know, everything is okay. She sounds amazing.
She really is.
And what I was going to say to you was just for definition, because I'm trying to teach everyone, you know, in the cheese world, I feel like we kind of brush past these terms really fast. Rotational grazing. How do you? I could try to describe it, but I think it's probably better coming from you. If you don't mind, just doing a short, brief description of what that is.
So, I usually try to preface this when people ask: is that most dairy farmers measure their success by longevity of their cows? So, you know, the way that you farm in Vermont is going to be very different than the way that you farm in California, than the way that you farm in South Georgia. It just so happens for us, what makes us so unique is that we are able to pasture our cows 12 months out of the year, because you need a minimum of 50 degrees to grow grass, and our average annual temperature is 67 degrees, and you need unlimited water. And we sit on top of the second largest aquifer of the nation, so we have a lot of water to be able to grow our grass. So if you go out west, it's too dry. You go up north, it's too cold. And you have to have a place to put your cows in barns. So
that's so really cool, by the way. I just have to say, I didn't know that about you guys. And I was like, whoa, okay.
Yes,
new fact for
is.
Me.
It's
excellent.
It definitely makes us very unique. And again, this was, you know, my parents were growing all of these crops when they had the conventional system, because in the conventional model, you just want to make more milk. So it's a very expensive model. You have to put in these barns and fans and cooling systems and misters and, you know, grow all these crops and have all these big equipment, machinery that, you know, chops and, you know, mixes all the grain and take it to the cows. And they just thought, gosh, there's got to be a better way. They're working themselves to death. And so my mom saw a conference of a guy from New Zealand that was teaching about rotational grazing, and she was like, again, visionary, knew that the best way to convince my dad that this was a good idea was for him to think it was his idea. So she signed him up.
Ooh, slick woman, I like it.
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah.
And he came back and said, oh my gosh, this is a great idea. Why in the world are we growing all these crops and bringing them to the cows? Why don't we just let the cows out and let them harvest all their own grass? And this is the way that it's done in New Zealand, where they have really, really friendly climates to cows and the ability to grow a lot of grass. They don't even feed any grain at all. And so basically the farm is set up, it's roughly 350 acres, and it's divided up into five-acre paddocks. So every 12 hours, they are rotated to a new pasture. So the purpose is to get the grass at the exact area where it's going to have the highest sugars, the highest, you know, nutrition for the cow, so it can't be too low to the ground where the cows might be grazing too close, that might have parasite problems, or so that it's not too big, because if it gets too fibrous, then you're losing a lot of that sugar in there. So really kind of grazing in that perfect time and letting the cows do all the hard work for it, which is how cows were designed. These ruminants.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, like, so is it like a timer, or you have a person like kind of like, hey guys, next patch, or like how do you know when it's too short? Like, what's the gift?
You know, that's a great question. And actually, you can see a lot of Kiwi dairy farmers, they walk around with a walking stick.
Mm.
And when my dad was first doing this, so they switched over in 1993. It was not a sight, you know, that was not uncommon to see my dad out there with a stick, a walking stick on one hand, and a refractometer on the other, measuring the Brix levels in the grass. And so it really is, another word for rotational grazing is intensive grazing management, because it is really intense. You're out there every single day mapping out, you know, for the next 48 hours or so of which pastures they're going to go to. So, But, you know, dairy farmers, I always tease my dad, he's like Goldilocks. It's either a little bit too wet or it's a little bit too dry. It very rarely is just right for him.
But, yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like that. I mean, you really have to have a certain mindset and love for it to be like, okay, guys, I think it's just about, okay, switch, you know?
So true. Well, my dad wasn't able to take vacation until my brothers came back. My middle brother went to New Zealand and worked after college on dairy farms, and, you know, my parents have a big saying that you could come back to the business, but you can't come empty-handed. You have to bring something back, bring some sort of knowledge, and so Clay went and studied in New Zealand and worked for some different dairy farmers and then came back and was able to give my dad a break. And in fact, they were, you know, in the mountains of Asheville, North Carolina last week. So I was so excited for them to have a little bit of a break, and Clay can hold down the fort.
Oh, wow. That's some well-rounded wisdom right there. You know, you can't just like show up. You got to have something to give, you know?
Yes, for sure.
Oh my goodness. So a clarification question. Is it, in my research, is Sweetgrass Dairy considered a farmstead cheesemaker then? Is this,
you know, it's so funny that you asked that question, because I'm getting that question more and more frequently than I did 10 years ago. And we do not actually make cheese on the property where the cows are located. We're roughly 25 miles away, but we are making cheese just from the milk from my parents' herd, which is a closed herd. And we want to have control, you know, over the cows from the time that they're babies all the way through milking. So, you know, on one hand, you know, we're not, the creamery is not located right there on the farm, but for all other intents and purposes, you know, the way that we farm, our mentality, the control that we have over the cows, the fact that it's a closed herd, we follow all of those farmstead principles as well.
Yeah, I guess then, I mean, in my opinion, you're a farmstead cheesemaker, but I know people get into the nitty gritty sometimes. So that's an interesting, it's very interesting. And I guess so in your last interview with Ann Saxelby, there was a lot of discussion about the Department of Agriculture in Georgia. And I'm curious, has it evolved since 10 years ago? Are they easier to deal with? Are they more appreciative of you? Anything?
Well, I will tell you that the Georgia Department of Economic Development is very, very thankful for
Oh, I bet.
our region.
Yeah.
So they have been super friendly. I will say that the Georgia Department of Agriculture is definitely better than 10 years ago. There's still some very difficult things to work through. But 10 years ago, we weren't allowed to age our cheese on wooden shelves, you know, because, you know, quote unquote, they harbored bacteria, which
right.
is exactly what you want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the worst thing. Of course it is. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but now they've passed the legislation where we're able to age on wood. You know, I think that 10 years ago, they were still testing just for coliform, you know, as a blanket, just bacteria count, which, as you know, when you make cheese, you actually add bacteria in cultures.
Yeah.
So it's not really a good measure of whether or not cheese is good or not. But the now we're testing for pathogenic bacteria, which is exactly what we need to be doing. So, yes, I would say that they're definitely better. And we always try to keep in mind that we really do have the consumer's best interest at heart. So even if it's something that we don't understand, we've tried really hard to partner with them a little bit better so that they will have, you know, we're both trying to protect the consumers and learn together. Because we're not microbiologists. We'll always be learning.
You're only cheesemakers. You know what? You know what can you do? Well, I guess then in terms of the economic development that you've done, which I know has been huge from reading about you guys, has I guess consumers have their perception of European style cheeses. Has that been broadened? Are they more receptive now since 10 years ago? Is that also evolved a little bit, do you think?
Yes. Well, at least in our little area, I would say so. You know, our whole county only has 50,000 people, and our town has 20,000 people. And it's really funny to see. In 2010, we actually sold the goats, and we opened a cheese shop downtown, right in this historic district of Thomasville. And it has grown into kind of its own little monster and become a full-fledged restaurant. So we have this really great craft cocktail program. We have a wood-fired grill. We have, you know, cheese boards, and we feature not only our cheeses but other like-minded producers that I love telling the stories of other cheeses. And so I think that, you know, it really has helped put us on the map locally here, but it really has helped open people's minds to cheeses. And we actually, in our town of 20,000 people, there are two cheese shops.
Really?
Restaurants here.
Oh, my goodness.
And thinking that it really is helping us tell the story of other like-minded producers. It's a lot easier than 2005, where we're just trying to beg people to even taste goat cheese for the first time.
I'm sure. I mean, trying to sell a camembert-style sweetgrass cheese, like you have the Green Hill, you know, it probably was a little bit like, oh, this is not a cheddar, you know, like those sort of, you know, it's not an aged sharp cheese. Oh, yeah, this is something different.
For sure. I mean, I think that the first 10 years that we were making cheese, we got asked for hoop cheese a lot, for cheddar, and for pepperjack. It was kind of the, you know, what people were asking. We didn't make any of those.
You're like, I'm not caving in. I'm not going to do it.
A little bit of an uphill battle.
But you do a pimento cheese, which I was very excited to get in the mail a sample from you. I'm like so excited to try this pimento cheese. Like I have it in the studio. I'm like gonna maybe in the second half I'll be able to wrestle it out of my bag. I'm so
well,
that
I
you
hope
do.
So you know, it's funny because we didn't start making pimento cheese until we opened the restaurant, and we wanted to have something that was easy that we could make with our own cheeses. So we use our Thomasville Tome. So it's the only raw milk pimento cheese that we know of on the market. And it became this kind of little cult classic just locally here. And then people were traveling and then asking, you know, they go back home and then they would ask us to ship them this pimento cheese. And Jeremy is so funny. He's not from the South, so he did not grow up eating pimento cheese. So he said, well, if we're going to make it, we're going to make the best possible pimento ever. So we used piquillo peppers and pimenton from Spain and some Dijon mustard and really just trying to make really high quality pimento cheese. So it's been a good addition to our line and kind of helping people remember that we are in the South. We're from Georgia.
Heck yeah. All right, cool. Jessica, on that note, we're going to take a quick break as I like maybe get some cheese out of my bag. So just hang on tight for 2 seconds and everyone will be right back. Mm-hmm.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Conte Cheese Association. Conte Cheese Association represents the Conte PDO, Conte Protected Designation of Origin, in the USA. Conte is a raw milk, cooked, pressed cheese from the Jura Mountains of France. There, every day, 2,500 family farms deliver milk to over 150 local cheesemaking facilities, or fruitiers. This milk must be transformed into Conte within 24 hours of milking to preserve the lactic microflora in the milk, ensuring the cheese's aromatic potential. About 105 gallons of milk are required to craft a single wheel of Conte. Conte takes time to acquire its flavors in the affinage cellars. After 8 months of aging by dedicated affineur on average, each wheel of Conte is graded and shipped to market. No wheel of Conte is the same. Its flavors speak to the pastures where the cows grazed, the season in which it was made, the particular craftsmanship of the cheesemaker, and the time spent in the aging cellar. Therefore, every wheel of Conte is unique. Learn more about Conte, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at conte-usa.com. That's conte-usa.com.
All right, welcome back everyone to Heritage Radio Network with Cutting the Curd. I'm talking to Jessica Little of Sweetcrest Dairy. I'm Kara Warren, your host. And we are talking about cheese from the South and a decade of difference. Boy, it has changed, I swear. I mean, everything we were just talking about in the first half of the show. I mean, Jessica, one thing that I loved from Ann Saxelby's last interview with you is you had a moment where you said, I hope one day we can ship pallets of our cheese to New York. Have you accomplished this goal?
We have. Now I'm trying to figure out how do we fill up at least half truckloads or truckloads.
Oh my gosh. But how does that feel as a cheesemaker? That I can't even, I mean, to go, now you're talking about, yeah, half truckloads? That's amazing.
Well, I don't know. I think we're always, logistics has been a really big challenge for us. I mean, there's strengths and weaknesses in being in a state where there's only six cheesemakers. You know, on one hand, it's great because there's not a lot of competition, but then it's also hard because it's lonely. It kind of feels like an island, whereas if you look at the Vermont cheesemakers, they've done such a good job at consolidating and being able to get their cheeses down to Boston or to New York, and so that it's not too expensive for distributors or end consumers.
It's a much more dense area, I feel like, compared to the South. I would bet it's a little more spread out in the South compared to the Northeast.
It is. We sure are. We just don't have a long history of cheesemaking, and there's not a lot of cheesemakers that are selling outside of kind of their immediate region or area. So, it is exciting to be able to put cheese on pallets, and I think it's better for the quality. If you're going to be sending them very far away, it's great to have it in refrigerated trucks. As you know, UPS is not always kind to perishable products.
Ooh, I remember there are sometimes I was like head of receiving at Murray's a million years ago. I remember we used to get some farms direct, and it was like styrofoam and random newspaper and a lot of, not you guys, I'm sure, but like oddball things you get tucked into the package just to make sure that cheese is safe, you know?
Oh my gosh. I think about some of the mistakes that we've made over the years in packaging, and I'm horrified of some of the things that we've done. But yeah, trial and error. It's just gaining wisdom. Some of those are painful life lessons, right?
I think, absolutely. I mean, I think your packaging, by the way, because you guys were kind enough to really send me samples, which I'm thrilled about. I have to say it was beautiful when it came in. It was like a little gift package that came to me. Great marketing, great branding. I know immediately it's from Georgia. I love the green and white logo. Is that something you handle yourself, or is that like a team effort that you guys do?
I'm a big believer in teams. We've got such a great team of people, not only on packaging, but Mallory is our marketing coordinator, and Liza in sales, and just really helping Sweetgrass Dairy succeed, because, you know, Liza is our national sales manager. She lives in California, and so she's able to see how other people are packaging and receive our cheeses in the mail and make sure, and, you know, giving feedback to our team, like, this is great, this, we need more ice, we need, you know, whatever that may be. So and Mallory is all about the experience of making sure that when you're unboxing that you know where it comes from and telling that story. So
yeah, it was perfect. I took notes in my brain. I was like, this is the way to do it. This is classy. They're classy people at Sweetgrass Dairy. I got
to
do better.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so another cool thing I wanted to bring up was the Georgia. Well, is there a Georgia Cheese Guild? That was another thing 10 years ago. There was none. Maybe there's a club now or some sort of thing that has evolved.
Well, we actually have the Southern Cheese Guild. So
okay.
We do not have one just for Georgia, but there is one for the South, which was in existence and then kind of disbanded for a few years. And now Luella has picked up the torch and is helping us get it back going again for, you know, telling stories of cheesemakers of the South and an educational resource, because, again, we're all so spread out, but there's some really exciting things happening in the South, from Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, Georgia, Alabama. I mean, there's just some really great stories to tell and great cheeses to share. So I'm excited. I'm on the board and trying to help revitalize this whole guild and help other people that would like to have resources and want to make cheese in the South.
I think that's super cool. I mean, even for agritourism, like, maybe there's a way, you know, people can come visit the farm, see the cheese making. Once you have a good group like that, and then you have a brewers, I mean, it just starts this like whole other tier that of the community that I think it just makes everyone's life better, right? I mean,
sure.
Yeah, I think you guys
there's a lot of value in fellowship, you know, of coming together, and we have a lot of the same struggles, and, you know, that we don't have to try to solve them all by ourselves. We don't have to reinvent the wheel and kind of leaning on each other to all become better.
I think that's wonderful. I mean, that's what we all need nowadays, you know, that's kind of like that next step. So that's good. Props to you. So let's get the numbers straight on this. You're 20 years Sweetgrass Dairy has been around. And now 10 years the shop has been around. You have four children. I mean, how do you do this all? I don't even know. And then I've also been told one of your sons, his birthday is coming up. Is this true?
Yes. Well, he just passed. Our youngest just turned 10.
Okay. Well, give him a shout out on the radio, because I was trying to get a shout out for him.
You're so sweet. Well, his name is Rowan, and so we have, like I said, four boys. The oldest one, we had a cheese named Gray's Goat, which was a goat milk version of Greenhill, that we no longer make, so we need to make another cheese for him. But Asher is our second son. We have Asher Blue. Our third son's name is Finn. His full name is Griffin, so we have a cheese named Griffin. And the youngest, Rowan, whose birthday just passed, does not yet have a cheese. So I'm just going to put it out here. The next time that we talk, maybe 10 years from now, we'll have another cheese named after Rowan to add to the collection. So happy, happy birthday, Rowan.
Woohoo! I love it. I have to say, beautiful names, you know, like, and it's great that you've mixed that into your cheese world as well, because I was thinking, like, how do they come up with these cheese names? So you beat me to the punch on that one. Is there a new style of cheese that you're working on right now, actually? Or is it just the core that you have right now?
Well, that's a great question. So we are, we decided by the end of 2014, we knew that if we were going to continue to grow Sweetgrass Dairy, because we also, as you probably remember too, in 2013, 2014, we knew that all this FSMA, all these food safety acts were coming down the pipeline, all these regulations. And we built the cheese plant, my parents built the current cheese plant in 2000 when there were no other cheesemakers in Georgia, so there were no regulations. So we knew that we would be out of compliance. And their goal in building the cheese plant was that if it was around for 10 years, it would be a good test kitchen. Well, Jeremy and I, when we bought it, what we did is we just started adding on. So it's kind of this Frankenstein building that's not very efficient, doesn't have great flow to it, so we don't practice any sort of lean manufacturing at all. and was not, we knew eventually it would not be in code or compliance. So we started talking about building a new production facility, and then 3 years ago we started working with an architect, and a year ago we finally got financing, and we should be in our new plant this summer, which is so exciting and such a long journey. And I think it's exciting not only to be able to make higher quality cheeses, but, you know, more volume to really help us grow, but also for Jeremy to have some R&D and be able to add more cheeses to our product line. As you can imagine, it takes several years to develop a new cheese, and the one that he's been playing with for the last year or so has been a Reblochon style, just because one thing that we know we probably will not do in Georgia is make cheeses that have to age for very long periods of time. So we probably will not be making any Alpine style cheeses or cheddars, you know, in big blocks that would need more than a year to age, because our biggest challenge is the heat. It just
costs
so much money to run coolers down here.
So and, heat and
so
humidity,
we need to focus
maybe?
On cheeses that are really, really delicious in 6 months or less. So who knows? I think the next several years are going to be really exciting to be able to add back some of our cheeses, because when Jeremy and I first moved back, my mom was making almost 30 different styles of cheese because she was doing cow's milk, goat's
milk,
mixed milk cheeses.
Yeah.
And we've had to pare them down, and we have a core of six now. But I think that it's going to be really exciting to start adding back more variety to this, to our product line.
Oh, that's amazing. Congratulations on getting a new production facility. That's like very, very cool. I mean, that'll put you, I mean, I guess before were you a Smedium, and now you'll be definitely a national brand. I mean, I like to think you're really going to get to all the regions after this, and that's really exciting.
It is really exciting. Yes, we do have distributors coast to coast, but we definitely don't have a lot of impact, say, in Pacific Northwest or Rocky Mountain region. You know, we definitely, I would not consider us quite yet a national brand. We've done a couple of national promotions, but nothing that I would, you know, this is definitely going to allow us to take more advantage of more of these retail placements. We've, you know, to be able to grow Sweetgrass, and I guess maybe just because Jeremy and I had more experience in restaurants, it was a little bit easier to focus on the food service side. But this will allow us to really grow the retail side of our business as well.
Yeah, baby steps. I love it, though. It's you've done it all. Oh, my goodness. I mean, in a decade later, it's going to be interesting to hear, like, I guess this brings together a good question. What do you foresee as the next 10 years from now? I mean, everything is kind of, we went from these small cut-to-order counters, and it is more like grab-and-go style now. That's the change I've seen in the retail side. But as a cheesemaker, will we have raw milk cheese? I mean, I don't know. What do you think?
It's a really, really good question. It's something that's definitely on the forefront of my mind. I think just from a personal standpoint, the next 10 years as, you know, trying to grow Sweetgrass Dairy, I think that so much of our success is going to be hinged on not trying to be a jack of all trade and master of none. It's just kind of where we feel like we are, is not being very effective or efficient, but really hiring people and building teams around us to help us get to that next level. Because, like I said, Jeremy's never going to be a microbiologist, and there's no way that I can, you know, be great at sales and marketing and HR and IT and finance and, you know, still try to run the business. You know, I mean, it's just not possible. And
yeah,
so
definitely.
I think that just from a personal development standpoint, we're going to have to really refine and have more clearly defined job roles. And it will be really exciting to see what the team is like in the next 10 years. From a bigger picture, and what I spend a lot of time thinking about, is the impact of plant-based foods and what, you know, consumers are going to support, how they're going to support animal agriculture. And I think that, you know, it is kind of a scary time for dairy farmers and cheesemakers alike. And there's no secret that for my brother, his success as a dairy farmer is hinged on us and us growing and making more cheese. Right now, last year we made about 380,000 pounds of cheese, which only translated to about 300 cows. And they actually have, my parents and my brother, between them, they have three different dairy farms that are all roughly 20 miles from us. So they're milking 1,500 cows. So the vast majority is just going to a co-op where they're not getting paid a premium the harder style that they farm.
Yeah.
And in order for Clay to stay in business, you know, or have the farm for his children to come back and take over if they want one day, we're going to have to make more cheese, and they're going to have to get paid a premium for that. I do think that there's always going to be a group of people that want to know where their food comes from, and, you know, cheese is it predates written history. It's, you know, from Old Testament and from the land of milk and honey, and there's something that's really satisfying and soulful about cheese. It's in the same family of foods like coffee and chocolate that evoke emotion. So I hope that there's always going to be the subset of people that will always support great cheesemakers and be a demand for that. And I think that we'll, as an industry, need to start talking about more and more of regenerative agriculture and the benefits that animals can have, like sequestering the carbon back in the soil. And, you know, that there are some really great things that happen when you farm in a really healthy and organic and sustainable way.
Oh, man. Thank you, Jessica. I think that's all really, I've also been reading things here and there about those sort of topics, and I'm glad to hear you talk about that. So thank you. I just want to say thank you for having me on thank you for being on the show. Pardon me, it's the middle of the day. Thank you for coming on the show. This has been wonderful. I was really looking forward to interviewing you. And I'm excited to just pass the word along about Sweetgrass Dairy. Thank you.
Well, you are so sweet. And thank you so much for calling. It's been a pleasure to speak with you, and I'm so thankful that you got our cheeses, and I hope you enjoy every bite.
I will. All right, listeners, thank you very much. This is Heritage Radio Network. You can follow me at Kara Warren. You can follow Sweetgrass Dairy at Sweetgrass Dairy. This was my episode with Jessica Little, owner of Sweetgrass Dairy, and eat more cheese.
Cutting the Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for...
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.